It is November 11th, 2013, and this is episode 42 of the Defensive Security Podcast. My name is Jerry Bell. As usual, I'm joined tonight by Mr. Andrew Kellett.
Episode 42, does this mean that this episode is the answer to everything?
It could very well be.
That would be pretty epic. Yeah. I'm not going to hold my breath or make that expectation for the fine listening audience, though.
Sorry. I think that's a safe bet. And speaking of that, the thoughts and opinions we express on this podcast are ours and do not represent those of our employer, especially if they're not right. So,
very true.
I would like to start off tonight, as I have for the last couple of episodes, talking about some things my friend Bob has told me
during the week. He's a busy boy.
Well, you know, Bob gets around.
He does. And
so he told me two things to pass on this week. Number one, that if you rely on people to determine what is a phishing email and what is not a phishing email, you will end up rebuilding a lot of PCs. And the other thing he told me is that if your business cannot afford downtime to rebuild a compromised server, you don't have a very good DR plan.
I would tend to agree. It's one thing we've said over and over again is plan for outages.
Yes.
Build an infrastructure that's resilient to an outage.
We are in business to support business.
Some folks can't afford that. I get that. They don't have the budget to do that, and I understand. And that is a problem, and I weep for you. But for those who do have the budget, and you're not planning for an outage, like a DDoS maybe, or a compromised server that has to get rebuilt, or whatever DR incident you want to think of, you're not doing yourself a good service there.
Yep. Well, there you are.
It's true. So, I learned, and this isn't a friend Bob. This is something I learned, is that if you log into a conference call with a bunch of other people and your name is present and you choose to walk away from the phone, inevitably you will be called upon at that moment, even though it was supposed to be just a listen and learn conference call. Your name will be called out and you will look silly.
Is that what will someday become known as Lurg's Law?
No, but I like it. We could work on that. Lurg's Law. Yeah. Inevitably, if you lurg away from your phone teleconference, your WebEx, your GoToMeeting, whatever it may be, because, you know, it's a silly sales presentation, you will be called out.
That's right.
That's what I learned.
Well, the next thing I wanted to talk about was, I lost my B-Sides virginity, on Friday.
That's true. B-Sides Atlanta.
Which was pretty good. I definitely thought, for me, my favorite talk was the one on phishing. I don't have the person's name who presented it, but I thought that was pretty good.
Yeah. I was there as well with Mr. Bell, and B-Sides is always, you know, well, I can only speak to B-Sides Atlanta and B-Sides Las Vegas, those that you have been to, but both really good events. And you know, some are hit or miss, right? It's all volunteer run and sponsored, and you know, this is a labor of love sort of thing. So some of the talks are, you know, maybe a little different than others, but it was good.
Yeah. I mean, the facilities were nice. They fed us well, and you know, there were drinks, and it was great.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think what you are speaking of is Cheat Codes: Level Up Your Social Engineering Game by Eric Smith.
That is the one.
Yes, and he goes by InfoSec Mafia on the Twitters and is actually one of the coordinators and organizers of B-Sides Atlanta. And He did give a very good talk about some really cool social engineering, physical security, and red teaming sort of stuff.
Yeah, and I think at some point those videos will be online. I know they did videotape them, and I know the previous 2 years are online, so I suspect this year's will be on, and when it becomes available, I'll post the link.
Wow. Yeah, hopefully my silly questions are not necessarily in those videos.
Ooh, that's a good point.
Yeah. Mm. But, you know, we'll see. yeah, you know, that was a pretty good one. You know, the keynote was kind of interesting, you know, and I don't want to take us completely off topic, but the keynote was being given by, let's see, I should have brought this
Kevin
up.
Green.
Kevin Green.
With the Department of Homeland Security.
Yes. And so he's in basically the DARPA equivalent in DHS, the Advanced Projects and Research something in DHS. And his whole thing was pushing a couple of different agendas, one of which was a free service, quote unquote, by the government to do code analysis of your code. You upload it and they'll scan it for you for free to help you find issues with your code. And they're also funding a bunch of startups that are offering interesting InfoSec tools and techniques, and it was interesting. Surprisingly, the crowd, given everything was going on and the type of crowd that goes to B-Sides, was relatively respectful and quiet, and you know, didn't heckle at all, and did a very professional job of nodding and smiling, and I got the vibe of, that's nice, but you're the government. No.
Yeah, we're from the government and we're here to help. Now I will say, you know, there's especially in the context of everything that's been going on lately, and you know, obviously the recent disclosures, you do have to wonder if everybody's motivations are pure. But one of the things I got out of it is that the marketplace that they were talking about, which oddly was called Swamp, you know, I'm not sure that would be my first name for a, you know, a place I want people to go.
That's the software assurance marketplace, aka yes. Swamp.
Swamp. The idea was you could volunteer your application to be thrown into the swamp and assessed, right? And then likewise, if you are a company that makes assessment tools, you could throw your assessment tool into the swamp and assess, you know, the other packages. And the idea would be that people who otherwise wouldn't get an assessment would get one done, and people who make assessment tools would potentially have the opportunity to, you know, tune their tools with actual programs. So, you know, who knows? I'm sure there's motivations that are not necessarily obvious. There always are, right?
Yep. You know, we'll see. You know, at the end of the day, you always have to ask, why should the government do X rather than, you know, the private market? Why is this the purview of a government agency to do this versus private individuals? That's always the first question I ask, because as a small government libertarian, I want limited government in general, and you know, it has to really justify its existence. And you know,
if you really want to know the answer, they have money that they need to spend. It probably isn't any more complicated than that.
Sad but true.
Anyway,
so otherwise, other observations or thoughts on your first B-Sides experience?
You know, get a good night's sleep before you go.
Yes.
So you don't end up at the back of the room snoring.
That was neither myself nor Jerry. That was an unidentified participant who punctuated the talks with snoring.
Yes, loud snoring too. Crazy. But no, I thought it was great. I definitely look forward to going back next year. Hey, the price is right. No doubt about that. It was nice rubbing elbows with other people from the community. And you know, for the people listening out there, hopefully you realize what B-Sides is, but you know, they're all over the country and in fact all over the world. And it's a really good opportunity to network with your peers. And apparently I've not been taking advantage of that.
No, you've been an InfoSec hermit.
I have. Yes. I have. Well, see, I'd like to think that I've been, you know, training in my ninja ways. You know, I've been...
Sweep the leg.
Anyway, let's move on.
Sweep the leg.
Sweep the leg.
Yes, I would concur. Go to your local B-Sides event. It's excellent. If you're at a company that could sponsor them, they deserve your money. And volunteer and help out your local B-Sides guys. They do a good job putting together a great con and deserve our support.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I will step off my soapbox.
All right. Step off, man. So we're going to move into stories now. And hopefully this is going to be a little shorter. So we've only got four stories, and they should go fast. First story is on Naked Security. I always feel a little questionable reading this at work. But hey, the title of the article is Anatomy of a Password Disaster, Adobe's Gigantic Size Cryptographic Blunder. And we talked about this a little bit last week, except at the time there was a lot of speculation and innuendo and uncertainty about things. And this article is pretty long and does a very thorough decomposition of the findings. And there's a couple of key findings and some, you know, support for what was discussed last week. Basically, against best practice, Adobe had used a symmetric encryption algorithm to store their passwords. So that means the encryption's reversible. And what's happened in the ensuing days is a lot of people have performed a lot of analysis on the data that was released. And so even though nobody apparently has the key to decrypt it yet, we actually know what quite a few of the passwords are. And the reason is that when you encrypt the same thing with the same key, you end up with the same ciphertext. And so what's different in this case is they didn't use the concept of a salt, because that doesn't really make sense with symmetric key encryption. But anyway, basically, we now know that in the case of this password dump, that the top 10 passwords were number 1, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, number 2, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, number 3, password, number 4, Adobe 1, 2, 3, number 5, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, number 6, QWERTY, number 7, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, number 8, 6 ones, number 9, Photoshop, there's a surprise. And then number 10, 123123. So people are really bad at picking passwords. Now, you might wonder, how did it come to pass that we were able to figure out what these passwords were? Well, along with, you know, the email address and the encrypted password was a password hint field. And a lot of people apparently very conveniently said what the password was in the password hint field. And so if you have, let's say, a million passwords that are all clearly the same, and, you know, five of them say password is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, well, you kind of know what all million of those passwords are.
Yeah, this was epic to me. This actually, I realized something about the password hint field that I had never realized before, which is that people use this really, really, really badly. They basically retype their passwords. So what this tells me is if I can get my hands on the password database, I don't even necessarily need to break the passwords. I can just look at the password hints.
Yes.
Which is usually stored in clear text from what I've been discovering.
Yes.
Which is, you know, note to self. Hash or you know, well, you've got to be able to recover that, so encrypt that in some way. Can't do it one way on that, but it was also interesting because if you figured out, because of the whatever encryption mechanism they used, and they're still debating, people think it's probably DES or triple DES, but that's unconfirmed. Once you knew one of the passwords, in other words, the actual encrypted ciphertext was the same for that password. So if I encrypted ABC123, every instance of that encrypted ciphertext was ABC123. Yep. So all I had to do was figure out once, right? So if based on the password hint, if it gave it to me once, all I had to do was find all the matching ciphertexts.
That's right.
And I've got all those, which is just epically wrong.
Well, it gets a little worse too, because the password scheme they used broke up the ciphertext into 64-bit blocks. And so this kind of harkens back to the old landman password days, where you kind of knew, you know, if a password was 7 characters or less, you know, or 8 characters or more.
Yeah.
In a similar situation is in play here. So they know, for instance, the approximate length of your password, if you know, based on 8-bit boundaries, basically, or sorry, 8-byte boundaries.
Yeah, there's so much cryptanalysis that you can do very, very, very easily against this data without even having to know the encryption scheme. It's pretty epic. And I just, here's the thing that keeps boggling my mind. To do it right would have been trivial. We've been doing it the right way for 30-some years.
For a long time.
And I don't understand why they chose to go down this route, unless it was just massive incompetence. I don't see any upside.
All I can say is, at some point, it made sense to someone.
Yeah, I guess. You know, I just don't understand the methodology or the reasoning behind it.
And we may never. So, anyhow, I think this is one of those lessons to learn by. You know, this is. Even big companies who have a lot of experience with handling complex security issues sometimes get very basic fundamentals wrong. And so, you know, this is, I think, something just to be mindful of.
Yep. And, you know, it doesn't hurt to have a third party occasionally do a sanity check on your design.
That's a good point. Very good point. All right. Let's move on to the next article from Network World titled Long Live Perimeter Security. So I've got a lot of thoughts on this one. You know, for a long time, people have, especially in the long time in the InfoSec world, have been decrying the death of the security perimeter and, you know, basically saying firewalls are dead and, you know, the perimeter is dead, and making jokes about the hard shell and the squishy middle and on and on and on. And that essentially is what part of this article is focused on. But they do a pretty good job, in my opinion, of kind of balancing out both views. And the other view is obviously that the perimeter really isn't dead. It's just good hygiene. It's not really any more dead than, let's say, antivirus is, right? Antivirus is not perfect, but it's still a key component in your security infrastructure. And the same thing goes with the perimeter. And there's a lot of reasons for that. I think not the least of which is that, as described in the article, the perimeter, what you know, we'll call the perimeter, is very effective at what I'll call filtering out the riffraff. And, you know, if you can block 90% of attacks, right, you can focus on the other 10%. And, you know, one thing that I'll say, and this isn't brought up in the article, but if you think about a network without perimeters, you basically are left, especially on an application perspective, really with what I'll call very traditional security controls, so primarily username and password. And so in the context of an intranet of an organization, that's usually okay. And not saying it's always okay. We know that there's plenty of times that that's been breached, but if you expose those systems to the outside, to the unwashed masses, you know, you're going to have all sorts of problems. You're going to have lots and lots more people banging on the doors. I think it's really, you know, I question the motives of people who decry the death of the perimeter, right? And I guess I can't say it any more clearly than that. What do you think?
You know, all right, let's take it from the top. Firewalls are not dead. We need firewalls. We need perimeters. It's a more complicated perimeter now. And if people can't understand or don't want to embrace the new level of complication, I can see them going, well, I can't handle it, so let's push all our defenses back to the critical data. No, you still need it, right? And we also don't want to let, you know, the perfect be the enemy of good enough.
Yes.
Are we finding all sorts of attacks that get around firewalls? Yes. Are we seeing a lot of code that works by coming from the inside out because of firewalls? Yes. The bad guys have adapted to the world of firewalls. I get it. Doesn't mean firewalls are pointless or useless. And of course, you know, we're saying in general firewalls as the primary thing. Perimeter security is more than that. But, you know, we don't have this nice, squishy, easily identifiable ingress and egress point anymore. However, we have them. You know, it may be more complicated, and it may mean that we need to have other mitigations in place, and it may mean that we need to take some more things into consideration. But that main ingress and egress points of your network still exist, and they still connect to the internet, and they still need to be defended. Now, does that mean that that's all you need? No. Right. Yes. You know, in this article, and I got to tell you, I was a little frustrated with this article because in many ways it sort of was like all these vendors, CEOs and CTOs going, my product is great for fixing XYZ. And this is something that frustrates me about Network World a little bit because it becomes like a, you know, a long opinion piece that turns into marketing at times and marketing fluff. In fact, the company I used to work for even got some airtime.
I saw that.
Which was kind of funny. You know, not that I disagree with any of their statements. It's just Network World's, you know.
Well, I think you're on a good point. It kind of meanders.
Yeah, it was end of the day. Let me sum up in this way. They put two people out on this article that say the perimeter is dead and like 10 people saying they didn't. That the perimeter's not dead, and said the same thing over and over again, which is it's just more complicated now, right? You've got perimeter, you know, you've got your traditional perimeter egress and ingress to the internet, then you've got your business partner connections, and you've got your BYOD connections and your private VPN connections, and yes, you've got all that, but you still have to understand where all those come in and out, and you still need to deploy the right technologies to, as best you can, mitigate these attacks and watch that data flowing across.
And you may need to segment more granularly, and you may need more perimeters.
That's a great point. Or you might have multiple rings of perimeters, right?
Yes.
You know, Jerry, you and I have built networks in the past where we had a lot of infrastructure at the core to protect things. Now, sometimes is a pain in the ass to manage, but it was effective in what we were trying to do, which was to isolate critical infrastructure from hostile portions of the environment. And at the end of the day, it comes down to a design methodology of an architecture of understanding where you want to put these controls in place. But there's nothing, you know, it's not like you have to put one firewall at the edge and you're done. You know, either I have the firewall at the edge or I don't. Yeah, can you tell me what I'm frustrated with this article? There's so many different ways you can build in traditional perimeter defenses at any different point on the network. It doesn't have to be. Now, bandwidth is a consideration and concern, of course, but you don't need to just put this at the edge. You know, maybe you put a perimeter around your critical servers. You know, like, let's go back to the PCI infrastructure for a minute. Most folks have isolated their PCI infrastructure to minimize their scope for all their PCI compliance issues. Similar concept can be applied to other areas, right? So this article just felt very unsophisticated and naive and you know, didn't seem to want to give you a third choice. And it was very black and white, and I just was not a fan.
Well, I feel the same. You know, there was a couple of quotes in there that I wrote down, and one of them was, and I these quotes resonated with me. One of them was, and I'm paraphrasing: data is no longer associated with a device; it's associated with a user. And I thought that was pretty interesting. In particular, the context was, you know, in particular, breaches most often occur now when people are posting data, and they could be posting data from anywhere, from their house, from their coffee shop, wherever. And so that was I think that was an interesting observation, although not particularly novel, you know.
I don't know if I agree with that stat, though, that breaches most often happen when someone is being careless with data, like working at home.
Actual breaches, I think I think the number one vector, if I'm not mistaken, is actually lost USBs. And
well, how do we define breach in that point? Just data that went missing?
Data disclosure.
Right. But actual published, you know, exploited breach?
Yeah, that's one of the problems, and in fact I want to talk a little bit more about that point in another podcast about, you know, the lack of good data around security incidents and breaches. I actually have been having a discussion on a mailing list about this very topic, and you know, there's work to do, but you bring up a good point that, you know, you depending on who you ask, there's a lot of wiggle room in how you define what a breach is. And you know, it's kind of, I had a math teacher that always used to say, you know, figures lie and liars figure. So you can make the numbers work out to whatever you want.
Sure.
The other quote I liked in this was that no sane company runs its own cache repository. And this actually resonated with me because of another article you sent me earlier today, which we're not going to talk about, but it was a security guide published by Amazon,
for their
Amazon Web Services, and it's very, very thorough and detailed and whatnot. And it really, really struck me that we are really at a time now where it is feasible to move your entire infrastructure into the cloud. Whether you're a small company or a very large company. And I think that the point of this quote is that, you know, the end game has already been, you know, predetermined. It's just a matter of how long it takes us to get there, right? You know, people don't store cash in their own offices anymore. How long is it going to be before people don't store, you know, data in their own data center anymore?
It's an interesting point. The only thing about that falls apart for me is cache is universally understood as valuable. Data maybe isn't, and different data means different things to different people. So, you know, and it's also, we're talking about something that is a physical security problem, you know, defending cache, storing cache. The other thing about that is, with the cache analogy, is you are able to shift full and complete liability to the bank. They will accept complete liability for whatever happens to that cache.
That's a good point.
That's not necessarily the case when you shift your data to the cloud.
Right.
So I think the liability issue still needs to be determined and figured out and fixed.
Yeah, I can't imagine that is going to resolve itself to the extent that the cache situation has, just because there's so much variability in the stupid crap people can do with their applications and whatnot. I just can't see a company like a cloud provider signing up for that kind of liability on things they don't have control over.
Right.
But I do think that there's a lot of value, you know, in the organization I'm in, I can see that consolidation happening. It's, you know, it's happening pretty rapidly, and it's being very disruptive to the server and, you know, and hardware market.
Yeah, and to be clear, I actually agree completely that most of this stuff is probably going to go to the cloud. And, you know, at the end of the day, if your core competency of an organization is not running a data center, why would you run it? You know, if somebody else's job is all they do is run data centers for people and secure it, et cetera, et cetera. There's going to be some efficiencies there. The only challenge I see is security is very difficult to commoditize and, you know, sort of chunk up into easy serving sizes. Servers you can do, you know, bandwidth you can do. Security is a very local and unique issue for each individual company and each individual bit of data. So, you know, how much security you throw around something is a very individualized decision based on what that data is worth to your company, the risks around it. You know, that's the area where it's just still too much of a squishy, complex thing to can truly just outsource and forget about.
It makes me wonder, though, if at some point in the future there's going to be a much more standardized model that might be delivered by the you know, the cloud providers, and maybe it's
possible.
a tiered thing that has some, you know, variability. But I don't know, you know, that's for the visionaries.
I think the technology would have to slow down on its innovation.
True.
I think if we can get to a more stable technology model,
yes,
which is the antithesis of the vendors, right? You know, we could probably have a really, really, really secure version of Windows Excel 2007, right?
Oh, that's an excellent point.
But they keep shipping new versions of Excel and Word and PowerPoint. How many different ways do, you know, I'm pretty sure that our word processing, you know, functionality has reached the apex of its needs.
Yeah.
Right. You know, there's really so many ways you can solve that business problem.
We're just moving around buttons now.
Right. But the problem is there isn't a value to an organization to have a secure version. There's a value to have a new version put out. Right.
Oh, that's right.
So
that's a good point.
So in some ways we need to slow down before I think we could commoditize security.
I will accept your point there.
And I'm not sure how we get down this path, but...
I don't know either. We'll have to go back and listen to it. So, all right, let's move on. The next story comes to us from... where does it come from? CNET. And, you know, I don't particularly like talking about Snowden for some personal reasons, but this story is titled NSA Worker Reportedly Shared Their Passwords with Snowden. And I thought this was worthy of bringing up because it highlights a really significant problem that I have seen a lot in my tenure. And that is password sharing. This is a very, very brief article, but basically the allegation is that there's about 20 to 25 people at the Hawaii NSA office where Snowden worked that apparently shared their ID with Snowden. And the allegation is further that probably enabled him to get access to a lot of the documents that he later leaked. And one of the points here is that you can have all of the monitoring and controls in the world, but if you have a legitimate user with a legitimate ID sharing their ID with someone else, you're up a creek. There's not a lot you can do. At some point, you really have to tackle this problem. Individual accountability is really a very significant problem, especially when it comes to forensic investigations and just really keeping a clean environment. You know, if you have 20 people with a root password and they can all get in and do crap, you know, you got no idea who to pick on when something goes horribly wrong. Whereas if, you know, you've got your root password vaulted and everybody has to log in as themselves and use sudo, you've got a lot more control and a lot more flexibility on response and situations. And I thought this article pointed out how important this concept is of making sure your people do not share passwords.
Yeah, this is a tough one to solve. This is much of a policy and cultural thing as anything. I mean, you could force two-factor everywhere, but even then, there's nothing that says somebody couldn't give up a token code and or a passcode. And, you know, it's a tough one. If someone's willing to give their username and password up, yeah.
That's right.
You know, what's interesting, though, from the article is that apparently those who did have been dismissed. I don't know they don't say completely from the NSA or at least from that project. So,
from their positions,
you know, if keep in mind, Sona was a system administrator, right? So it's somewhat legit for him to make a request like this, although we know it's not, but to the users, it may seem that way. And, you know, this is a bit of a user education thing, but this is a tough problem to solve. At some point, you know, we've got to trust something, or we go to something that's too difficult for right. users to use on a daily basis, you know? And these are, I'm guessing these are probably AD credentials, most likely, or something similar, like some sort of federated, you know, yep. system. So it's a tough one, you know, and I don't think users are going to tolerate a three-factor biometric smart card password login scheme. That's just not going to fly, right? You know, maybe in certain applications, but.
Yeah, and it may not actually end up helping all that much either. If he can con someone over to his desk and have them log in for him, you know.
Yeah.
It is a really very, very difficult problem.
You know, I guess I could, you know, there's some tech out there that can watch login activity
mm-hmm.
and spot reuse, spot out of norm behavior, perhaps. Suddenly, why is this user logging in from this box I've never logged in from before? I mean, I could start to conceive of some of that sort of technology to take a look at login behavior and spot anomalies. You know, why is suddenly Bob logging in at 2 a.m. when he never does that? You know, maybe that's an option, but that's anomaly detection is tough. And certainly not foolproof.
Yeah, definitely. I thought it was interesting because here you have an agency where the people should be above the norm in terms of their paranoia. And, you know, obviously they probably would be extremely resilient to someone from outside the organization asking for their username and password. You know, they're I would imagine they're really highly trained to avoid that kind of situation, but you know, here you are.
Yep.
It was an insider. So anyhow, watch that password sharing. All right, the last story we have for tonight is about an Internet Explorer 0 day that is kind of happening real time right now. This is a brand new 0 day. You know, we still have this 0 day in Office out, you know, that hasn't been patched yet.
For the record, this is not a repeat of last week, the previous week, last month, 2 months ago, 4 months ago, 6 months ago, 8 months ago.
It's all new,
you know.
Yep, hot off the presses.
I know, it's shocking and stunning. There's an IE O day.
It is more shocking and stunning that there are people still using IE. But
all kidding aside, this is a pretty serious one.
This is a serious one. And I normally wouldn't bring up something like this, but it brings up an attack technique that I thought worthy of discussion, and that is, you know, this attack uses, it's obviously a 0 day. FireEye is associating this with the Deputy Dog APT attack against Japan and whatnot. Apparently, it was being delivered through a compromised website. They haven't said which website it was, other than that it was of interest to people who are interested in national and international security. So, you know, take that for what it is. And this exploit basically takes advantage of a flaw in, I think it's IE 7, 8, 9, and 10, if I'm not mistaken, different variations between Internet Explorer, I'm sorry, between Windows XP and Windows 7. Both platforms are vulnerable, but different versions of IE on both. Interesting that Microsoft's EMET does apparently block the attack, so you know that's good. But here's the rub: this exploit, the payload that is delivered with this particular attack, never touches the disk. It's yeah. entirely in memory. And if you're not familiar with this, that kind of attack evades almost every antivirus engine. out there. This is something that AV usually is totally blind to, because nothing gets written to the file system, and therefore AV never gets alerted to, hey, you need to go look at something.
Yeah, I'd be really curious how a whitelist player like a Bit9 would deal with this. I honestly don't know, and I'd be very curious.
I am too, and I actually am going to go find out for my own reasons. I did have a discussion with a vendor today, and at least one of the vendors, and I'm not going to say who, says that they would have blocked this and that the other players wouldn't.
But of course, they all are going to say that.
And right. That's the reason I'm not naming names.
Yeah.
Because it was a salesperson. So, and, you know, we all know how that works. So anyhow, this is a really dangerous situation. And in my mind, points out how important it is to use a tool like Emet, because, you know, this stuff is going to happen. And also, everything we've talked about in the past about, you know, defending against malware and you know, people being susceptible to watering hole attacks is really dangerous. Now, there was another article today, and I think you sent it to me, about how after you reboot, the infection goes away because, again, it's a memory resident,
right?
You know, exploit and payload. But the problem is that the payload that's delivered is a, you know, it's a Trojan. And so once it's infected, it, you know, it reaches out, lets somebody do stuff on your system. And presumably that could then be used to establish some form of persistence that would potentially write to the disk.
Yeah, it could certainly be a dropper and other things. And
exactly.
You know, it's somewhat counterintuitive as well. If you're not writing to disk, you're not persistent over a reboot. You know, that seems like a counterintuitive method. But if you're using it for initial breach point, yeah, it makes sense. Who knows? You know, we're always assuming that the bad guys are infinitely smart. Maybe they're not.
Well, that's true.
Yeah, until they're willing to come on the show and
defend their position. Yes.
Yeah.
So anyhow, you know, this is in my mind another reason that we need to be very skeptical about the contemporary defensive technology, and it's not perfect. There are holes that you can drive right through and your technology won't see it. It's, again, as we talked about, it's not even clear if, you know, something as aggressive as application whitelisting would stop this. It might not. You know, I don't particularly know, but I do know that AV won't catch this.
One thing I did want to kind of bring up is kind of reinforcing the Microsoft Emet tool, which is Enhanced Mitigation Experience Toolkit, which is an interesting little piece of kit.
Yes.
That you can wrap around code and wrap around executables and in theory prevent them from doing weird things that Microsoft basically puts out for free. It takes some manual heavy lifting, but if you're not aware of it, you don't know about it, go look it up. Microsoft Enhanced Mitigation Experience Toolkit. It's an interesting little thing to have in your tool bag.
Yeah, I totally agree. In most cases, it's totally transparent. There are a few things that it breaks. I'm trying to remember which thing recently I remember it breaking.
Yeah, you have to be careful. You have to test it extensively. Like, read all the disclaimers. This is not foolproof. It will break shit. Test it first.
Yeah, basically, it enforces the use of ROP, anti-ROP, and ASLR, and DEP, and a few other techniques. Normally, those protections are optional for code, and so what Emet lets you do is apply a mandatory policy for those protections around an application or a piece of code, and not let them out. And so if you have an application that has a hard reliance on, let's say, something residing at a particular memory address, that's going to break. But fortunately, there isn't a lot of that anymore. I'm trying to remember, there was one thing, fairly high profile, I remember, that EMET broke recently. But anyway, for most people, it's probably not going to cause a big problem. And it really is a great piece of technology. All right. So with that, we're going to talk very briefly as a part two to our advanced malware session. I just had a few additional thoughts, and I think we talked about this last 2 weeks ago, and we said we were going to bring it back up, and here we are. So, you know, in addition to what I brought up before, there were a couple of other things that I wanted to bring up. And number one was the concept of making sure that your employees or your user population uses full tunnel VPNs. And it might not necessarily seem completely obvious, but you know, I've seen this personally before, that when you don't do that, if somebody's at home and you're using a split tunnel type of system, it provides a really great reflection point into your environment, and a lot of the defenses that you have aren't applicable to them. And the other thing in line with that is using agent-based web filtering. So a lot of organizations, for you know, good economic reasons, deploy network-based web filtering, and they do good stuff, blocking known malware sites, known command and control hosts, all that stuff. But if your workstation or your laptop is disconnected from your network at home, that policy is not enforced. And so that's something I've actually found to be pretty effective. And the only other thing that I would bring up is the concept of building a capability for retrospective analysis in your environment. So, you know, there is a limited ability for you to prevent advanced malware. And so what you want to be able to do is, you know, again, if this is something that your organization is interested in doing, is build the ability to figure out what happened when this thing happened. Hopefully you have some detective capability that at some point alerts you, you know, that there's something going on. But what you don't necessarily have is a good view of what did they do while they were on your network. How did they get there? And what did they exfiltrate? And that sort of thing. So, you know, there we had a listener write in and remind us about the concept of, you know, network recorders. And you know, I think that's an interesting idea. I actually had, not long ago, read someone recommending, you know, the ability to, or implementing the ability to, kind of on a rotating basis, record, you know, about 3 to 10 days of traffic coming in and going out of your internet gateway. And that could be a lot of traffic. I mean, no doubt about it. But the point was, disk space is relatively cheap. And the ability that gives you to go back in time and figure out exactly what happened is definitely going to be worth more than you'd spend. So that was what I had.
Yeah, no, I agree with you on all points. Those are great points. And I've preached for a while now that the right time to figure out forensically what happened to an attack is, you know, the right time to set up that equipment is long before the attack occurs. And if you're not instrumented properly at the network level beforehand, you're going to have a lot of trouble recreating and understanding what happened, because obviously you can't trust the host or the server once it's been popped. So you really need some good network level recording as best you can.
Definitely. So any other ideas from you?
There's so many things you can do with advanced malware. You know, I think it really comes down to a lot of blocking and tackling and a lot of the basics. You know, understand that the way you can pick this up a lot of time is based on network behavior. The way you can pick this up a lot of time is based on anomaly. It's always going to be a moving target. There is no silver bullet. It's layer upon layer of detection, and an understanding of quick remediation once you know how. The other thing is, I was having a debate with somebody the other day, is whether or not you can remediate a host with advanced malware and actually clean it up and put it back on the network. I respect other people's opinions, but I'll tell you, I would never trust a box that had been popped by advanced malware ever. Especially when we're seeing proof of concept of code that can hide in BIOSes and hide in video cards.
Yeah, and, exactly.
God knows what else. I just personally cannot vouch for a box being put back on the network after it's been popped by advanced malware. Because the whole concept is it can download additional things. So you have no idea. Even if you've got really good forensics and have found the code that was originally detected, you have no idea what else that code did. I mean, you could potentially, I guess, reverse engineer it, but how do you know if that's the code that was on there originally? It could have replaced some other code. You don't know. You can never know. I would just... unless you can categorically prove that it wasn't able to connect out at all, there's just too many variables.
There was a great talk, and I don't remember which Security Converse it was, but it was by, I believe, Mark Baggett and another person whose name escapes me. And the name of the talk, if I recall, was Wipe the Drive. And their point was, these guys are very experienced penetration testers, and their point was that there are so many opportunities to maintain persistence that it is a hopeless task to figure out all of the different ways that someone could maintain persistence. I mean, everything from running scheduled jobs to hiding a clone of an executable that really isn't the executable. So the next time somebody tries to start up Notepad, it's actually launching, a very rudimentary shell that reaches out and downloads something more advanced.
Sure.
There's just so many opportunities. You really have no hope of going through all the different permutations of what someone could have done to your system. I mean, it's like trying to prove a negative. You just can't do it.
And this is where techniques like virtual desktops come in handy, where if you don't want the pain of re-imaging, well, restore a known good and make sure it's known good image, right? Is kind of going back to the concept of thin clients in many ways. But anyway, I digress. We could talk for days on advanced malware. It's a tough, tough topic, and there is no silver bullet, regardless of what the marketing folks will tell you. I think it's just a matter of layers, and we covered it pretty extensively in the other show as well. But this is a topic we're going to come back around to as things evolve.
Yep. Last time we mentioned relatively briefly the concept of things like FireEye, and I know SourceFire has one, and a bunch of others.
Yeah.
It was interesting. Not long after we released that episode, was the RuxCon conference in New Zealand, and on Patrick Gray show Risky Business, he interviewed a guy who, again, I'm terrible with names, gave a talk about how relatively ineffective things like FireEye are, and went through some really pretty detailed descriptions of their faults. So that's worth a listen if you're interested. I think it was the Risky Business from 2 weeks ago. It was a good 15-minute segment. Definitely worth a listen. And if you don't listen to that one, that's one you should put into your MP3 player.
Yeah, I'll have to check it out. I have not listened to it. The one thing I will say, though, watching this industry, is there's always ways to poke holes. It doesn't it doesn't mean the technology isn't useful. There's always ways around it, right? So be careful not to throw out the baby with the bathwater on things like that.
Yeah, I can tell you that I have personally seen it do some really good things. And in fact, I think I think it was FireEye in their network who actually saw this latest Internet Explorer thing.
Yeah.
And I think you're absolutely right. I think the point is that despite the marketing again, you can't you can't entirely trust it, right? You can't put it out there and say, hey, you know, we're good.
Right.
It is a you know, it is one more layer on your defenses. It's not the savior.
Right. Yeah, and that's the key, right? It does certain things. It's not the silver bullet. It's not the magic bullet. And by the way, the counter of this is there are vendors out there, by the way, whose code and gear does suck, right? So yes. Keep in mind that, you know, for lack of a better term, caveat emptum, you know, you got to buyer beware.
And, that's right.
You know, but don't also fall into the trap of, oh, well, it can't catch this on Tuesdays when the wind's blowing from the east, so I'm not going to buy it. Right. That doesn't mean that it isn't very effective on all the other stuff it does, whatever the technology may be. Just know what it can do, what it can't do, what it's meant to do, and keep up to date on this stuff. There is no perfect. It's really, really, really a hard problem to solve. And if you're waiting for the perfect solution, you're not going to find it.
Yeah, I dare say that there are, I think there are solutions out there. It's just that they're too unpalatable and too painful for people to really, you know, accept. Yeah. Although, you know, even air gapping systems, as we just saw today, right, or very recently, you know, we just saw a piece of malware jump a very large air gap.
In space, no one can hear your exploit.
Yes. So what we're talking about is apparently Eugene Kaspersky mentioned at a press conference that some Russian cosmonauts apparently infected the International Space Station with malware using a USB drive. And this goes to the point that air gaps are only high latency links. And with that, I think we will call it a day, except I will tell you, I'm reading a new book.
You just don't know how to go out on a high note, do you, Jerry?
I don't. I'm sorry. This book is written by some of the guys over at Paul.com, John Strand in particular. It's called Offensive Security. I don't remember what the subtitle is.
I'll tell you, you're offensive, all right.
But you kind of have to get past the grammatical errors and whatnot. It's actually a really good book. My problem right now is I happen to work for an attorney, and it is causing me to have flashbacks to my day as an English tutor when I was in college. Anyway, so right now I'm in this mode where, you know, grammatical errors stick out like a sore thumb to me. But anyway, it's actually a really good book. I'm about halfway through it. I would already recommend people read it. It's pretty cheap. I think it was like $10 or $12. Quick read, and it gives some really good ideas on placing honeypots and different things like that. So anyway, check it out. I'll give it maybe one thumbs up, not necessarily two, because of the grammar. But in any event, I will. I think I'm going to wrap it up now. As usual, we appreciate your time and attention. Our listener base has grown significantly. I think we're up to 6 listeners now. So, my mom started listening again, so that was good. If you have any comments, questions, critiques, ideas, thoughts on things you'd like to hear us cover, please send us an email to info@defensivesecurity.org. You can hit us up on Twitter @DefensiveSec. You can find me on Twitter @MaliciousLink. You can find Mr. Callett on Twitter @Lurg. You can find the show notes, all the old episodes and whatnot, on the website at www.defensivesecurity.org. And if you would be so kind, please log into iTunes and give us a good rating. We'd appreciate that. And with that, I bid you adieu for another week. Have a great one. Bye.